Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. This is Norm Diamond, your host this morning. Patricia Kohlberg is our producer. This past week was the Howard Zinn Centennial, the 100th anniversary of his birth. Zinn's book, A People's History of the United States, has sold close to 4 million copies. There were multiple celebratory events online last week, workshops and panels for teachers, historians, artists, and others, some of which we'll hope to bring you in the future. You might remember Matt Damon's character in the film Good Will Hunting saying of A People's History, "That book will knock you on your ass." We have a diverse program for you this morning, from sex ed to climate change, to what's being called the new pink tide in Latin America. Jan Hocken will interview Sharon Grant and Judy McFarland, retired sex educators in Multnomah County middle and high schools, on the challenges resulting both from the pandemic and changed social interactions for young people, and the backlash now against any sex ed in schools. Bill Resnick talks with Howie Hawkins, the Green Party's presidential candidate in 2020, on Biden's Inflation Reduction Act. What vision of climate change does it embody, and in whose interest? And I'll talk with Alex Diamond about developments in Colombia and Latin America more broadly. In the recent presidential campaign in Colombia, people wore T-shirts saying, "Hoy ganamos los nadies." Today, we, the nobodies, win. And win they did. That identification, the nobodies, has been a particular theme of Colombia's new vice president, Francia Márquez, a black woman feminist and environmental activist. Here's what she said at the inauguration. "After 214 years, we finally have a government of the people, a people's government, a government of people with calloused hands, a government of ordinary people, a government of the nobodies of Colombia. Sisters and brothers, let us bring reconciliation to this nation. Let's go for peace in a decisive way with love and joy. Let's go for dignity. I am the first woman vice president of Colombia. I am your vice president." That was Francia Márquez. That election of Gustavo Petro as president, a former underground activist jailed and tortured by the government, and Francia Márquez is being written about as the fulcrum of a new left-wing governance across much of Latin America, not only new but of a new kind. Alex Diamond has been living in and writing about Colombia for 6 years. He's a PhD student at University of Texas in Austin, who taught high school in Memphis before teaching in South Korea and Peru. His work, the past few years, has centered on the peace process in a Colombia torn by internal war and on the role of the state. Alex Diamond, you've been on the Old Mole before, but remind us, what's your work? What are you doing in Colombia?
Well, I've spent about 3 years total living in a Colombian village that gets called the Peace Laboratory. It's Briceño, Antioquia, that has been a key area for the implementation of Colombia's peace process, which was signed in 2016 with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or the FARC. So I've been researching basically what this peace process has meant as part of a larger transformation for this village, which includes transitioning away from a coca economy, coca being the raw material for cocaine, and it also includes Colombia's largest hydroelectric dam.
Researching and writing about those issues, how does the election fit into all that, and what significance do you find in the victory of Petro and Márquez?
So I started my research in this village in 2018, which was Colombia's last election, which was a tremendous disappointment for last presidential election, which was a tremendous disappointment for many people because the winner was Iván Duque, who represented a return to the past. He was sort of put in power by Álvaro Uribe, who's kind of the boogeyman of Colombian politics, known for paramilitary support, human rights violations, right-wing economic policies. In that election, Petro, Colombia's new president, came in second, which was actually historic because it was the first time that a left-wing candidate had even arrived to the runoff election. But in the four intervening years, the president, Iván Duque, who's now out the door, dismantled the peace process as he promised to do, or at least as much as he could. He defunded it. He pushed the country to more militarization. He continued the path, what gets called neoliberal reform, including lots of foreign investment, lots of extractivist mining, petroleum projects. And essentially, for an already pretty significant population of poor people in Colombia, life got much harder. So with Petro, there's, I think, a tremendous hope and justified hope that the country will become more equal, but also that the peace process will be reclaimed.
In Colombia, the phrase they use is Petro en Francia, last name and first name for the president and the vice president. This came about through what they call an historic pact, Pacto Histórico. Tell us about that. Who's part of it? How likely is it to stay together?
So there was a tremendous, and still is a tremendous, framing from the Pacto Histórico, which is this political group that has developed that this is, and it's accurate, this is the first time in Colombian history that there's been an alternative to either the traditional parties, which was for all of Colombian history until the beginning of the 21st century, either liberals or conservatives, both of which were pretty conservative, frankly. The break with that was to the right. So this is the first time there's been any sort of leadership on the left. And their framing was this is an historic moment. And also, and I think this is accurate, Petro has run before. He ran in 2010 and 2018. But as a more left-wing, slightly more radical candidate. I mean, his background is actually being a member of a guerrilla movement, not for 30 years, but that's certainly something that was used against him. So this was sort of a reframing that it's not just Petro, it's not just the left, but that they're actually including a lot of more centrist viewpoints, which I think is accurate now. Even beyond the Pacto Histórico, he's made a number of alliances with the Liberal Party, which I just said is not liberal, however you define liberal, because it is liberal in what we think of as the neoliberal sense. But he's absolutely made alliances with more center to even right-wing parties in order to get votes he needs in Congress.
Tough question, then. How do you assess that? He's needed to compromise, is what you've just said, in order to be elected, in order to be in the position to do anything. Is he too compromised? Is this going to affect the possibilities for what he can accomplish?
I think this is a really interesting strategic move because he's clearly, and that this represents a change from 4 years ago when he ran, but it's kind of a real politic approach of softening his stance in ways that some people like me wish, or to some extent wish that he hadn't done. You know, after being elected, he gave a speech, which was the night of the election, a wonderful speech that also included, you know, saying very clearly, we're not here to go against capitalism. And then he met with Cesar Gaviria, who's was president of Colombia, like 1990, is known for leading the what's called the apertura, the economic opening of Colombia, Colombia's entry into the age of neoliberalism. And Gaviria proudly made this announcement after their meeting that, you know, we met together, we came to agreements, and I and the Liberal Party have saved capitalism. And Petro didn't say, no, this is not true. What he said repeatedly is, no, I'm not anti-capitalist. We need a capitalism that's that has people's interests and needs in mind. Also, if you look at his appointments of ministers in the government, there are a number of ministers he's appointed that might have been disappointing, people who served in the government of Juan Manuel Santos, who was president from 2010 to 2018, and sort of fit this rhetoric of, no, we're not making these extreme changes, where he was accused of being communist, for example, or socialist even. He said, no, we're not making these extreme changes. We're allying ourselves with more moderate or even right-wing political forces. And the trade-off is that if he didn't do this, you know, he does not have a majority in Congress. And Colombia, a lot of governance actually happens on the margins, and particularly in the areas that are racked by violence. So that's actually something you can see in the village that I live and work in. He's allied himself with these traditional interests who are often corrupt, and they're often they use clientelist relations to maintain power. They use state resources, distribute them to their supporters in order to guarantee continued political support. He's allied himself with all of these groups who do these things in order to be able to push through maybe more limited reforms, but in order to be able to get these reforms done. So I think it's a really interesting sort of looking at his appointments and the tax reform bill that he's pushed through, and a few other things he's done since coming into office. You know, you can see that he actually has thought a lot about, you know, what's the best way to cause change over just a four-year period, going against 200 years of a particular kind of rule in Colombia.
That approach, the compromise, the practical assessment, is being characterized as the new pink tide in Latin America, that it's different from left approach to power, to political power before. After a bit, I want to get talking about Latin America more broadly. I do want to mention at this point, of course, that his choice of running mate was, if anything, to the left of him, if that kind of spectrum makes sense. So social movements in Colombia that his vice president, Francia Márquez, comes very strongly out of, the election, how do you assess the relevance of the street protests that led up to the election the entire prior year in Colombia?
Yes, I think first it is really important to recognize the importance of Francia Márquez as running mate and now vice president. She's an Afro-Colombian woman who comes out of anti-mining and anti-dam, anti-hydroelectric dam activism from a very poor upbringing in a country where women and Afro-Colombian communities have been tremendously marginalized in politics and in general. And he chose her as a running mate in part because she came in a strong second in their in the primary election that they did with the Pacto Histórico. So she became this tremendously, or she has become a tremendously popular sort of symbolic representation of a marginalized group of Colombian society, which she's referred to as las y los nadies, the nobodies, maybe now having some political voice, where they have been active in social movements, but that have often been repressed by the state. So to bring it full circle and to answer the question you actually asked me, there was tremendous, tremendous social movement activism and street mobilization during the presidency of Iván Duque. And there were sort of these touchstone issues that set off protests, but the protests gathered thousands, tens of thousands, in some cases even hundreds of thousands of people around a number of issues. The most recent one was 2021, which was in response to this tax reform that Duque suggested, that raised taxes on foods that poor and middle-class people depend on to eat, like eggs, for example. That there was this became this huge cultural symbol of the tax minister having no idea, the guy who proposed the reform having no idea in an interview what eggs cost. It would be like me saying now that a dozen eggs costs like 30 cents now, so we're just taxing 20 cents on top of that. So the people made fun of this, but at the same time, it reflected this broader feeling that the government was completely not in touch with the struggles of poor and even middle class people in Colombian society. But those uprisings, also very much reflected anger about what happened with the peace process, anger about Colombia seeming to again degenerate into violence with armed groups controlling large sections of the countryside and little state investment in these areas. So all of these mobilizations together are, I think, rightly given credit. Petro's candidacy in 2018 was not a beginning, but it was a lot of the same people and same organizations supported him. After he lost in 2018, there were tremendous accusations of fraud. I think that was even part of the mobilizations. It's clear that electoral fraud took place. It's unclear, based on my analysis, whether Petro would have won without the fraud. But this sort of uprising that brought in a number of different specific complaints, Petro's candidacy was sort of part of that, and he was sort of a figure, not that he was the one who organized the protests, but, you know, he's the candidate of that uprising, and sort of everyone knows that. And on the day of his inauguration, he brought in on stage with him the mother of Dilan Cruz, who was killed by Colombian riot police. There were, in these uprisings in 2021, there were probably about 200 people killed by Colombian riot police and normal police, just tremendous repression. So he sort of nodded to this movement in a gesture that I think was very respectful, and certainly nothing that anyone in that position of power had ever done in Colombia by bringing the mother of this protester up and sort of acknowledging this movement that that really did bring him to power.
I've been very impressed between the election and the inauguration. Francia Márquez traveled throughout Latin America, and she met, of course, with political leaders in a number of countries. But in each one of those countries, she met also with the social movements and made a point of emphasizing that was the constituency that Petro and Márquez, or Petro and Francia, came out of.
Yeah, no, I think just choosing her, because Petro himself, despite his guerrilla background, has been a part of mainstream Colombian politics for 20-something years, beginning as, as a member of the guerrilla. He was a city council person in Zipaquirá. But yeah, choosing Francia Márquez as his running mate was certainly, and she's internationally famous as an activist, and for using contentious politics. So it's not surprising that she would associate with social movements, but I think it was very clearly a strategic move, and they're maintaining their social bases and looking for allies even in countries that do not have leftist leadership.
Point may be obvious, but say a little bit about what they're up against now that they've taken the position as president and the Pacto Histórico is in the parliament.
Well, so they're up against an economy that has collapsed, that is in terrible shape for poor and even middle-class people. Most Colombians do not, the majority of working Colombians do not have formal jobs, which means that in many cases, you know, people are living from selling gum on the bus, or they're, they go to a market and they buy 20 pounds of tomatoes and then break them into 1-pound bags and sell those at limited profit. There are a lot of Colombians, probably most urban Colombians, live off of these kind of just rebusque, it gets called, just a hustle. Even Colombian minimum wage is now, it's less than $250 a month. If you do the conversion, the price of food has gone way up. People are really struggling to live. I think that's the first major challenge that Petro faces as president. For his programs, for the programs that he wants to institute to alleviate that poverty, there isn't, the government doesn't have money to do that. The government is in debt. Debt went up tremendously during Duque's presidency. So that's another challenge. And he's already introduced a tax bill to try to raise that money by taxing the rich more. And that's also a tremendous challenge, is when you think about giving resources to the poor, some level of redistribution, it's basically a zero-sum equation. You have to take from some people to give to others. And the elites of Colombia feel very threatened by Petro. So there was this tremendous discourse of, oh, Petro won, now we have to leave the country. As far as I know, and to my chagrin, because I flew back to the U.S., just a couple days before, maybe 2 days before Petro took office. I'm the only person who actually left right before his inauguration. And not intentionally, not for that reason, for a previous commitment. But yeah, there's fear or thoughts that with new tax structures that elites will pull their money out of Colombia, Colombian elites, as well as foreign investment, and that would further weaken the economy.
I can think of a couple of other factors that they're up against, but one of them we have to comment being where we are, and that's the United States' response. U.S. has 7 military bases in Colombia, is Colombia's major trading partner, etc. How do you think the U.S. will respond?
So it's a good question, and I think it's a little unclear and will depend a lot on who's the next president of the U.S., obviously. We should note, actually, I would like to give Petro credit for now he's, after saying he was going to do it, now the National Colombian National Police have announced that they are no longer going to target coca through forest eradication, which is a fantastic policy decision that goes against U.S. war on drugs rhetoric that has for decades pumped billions of dollars into Colombia and specifically the Colombian military, and has also been just a tremendous focus of U.S. foreign policy vis-a-vis Colombia. I think it's worth pointing out that the importance of cocaine in the U.S. has gone down. I think this country now consumes roughly half of what the amount of cocaine that we consumed maybe 20 years ago. And this war on drugs rhetoric, I think there's been more and more pushback from South American governments, led by Evo Morales, of course, in Bolivia. But now, even in Colombia, in the last 10 years, there's been pushback against using glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup to airily fumigate coca crops. And now Petro possibly pushing for decriminalization of coca, and then specifically saying that in terms of interdiction, which is, I think for anybody who follows policy, this is sort of an obvious policy, but that what he wants the military to do is focus on ports and shipping of cocaine, which is the part of the economy that really, one, produces the most amount of money, and two, causes the most violence. And basically to leave farmers be, but give them support to substitute coca for other crops. So this is an example of Petro going pretty directly against what U.S. foreign policy has pushed for in Colombia for decades with all U.S. presidents. Biden was actually one of the authors, I believe, of Plan Colombia, which was the major funding initiative beginning around 2000 that pumped $10 billion of U.S. aid into Colombia with conditions. But it certainly does represent a loss of U.S. influence in Colombia being, or having been for decades, the South American country that that has most allowed the U.S. to put soldiers there, and has been the country that really props up U.S. foreign policy in South America. So it remains to be seen how much of a response there's going to be to that. Other reforms that Petro has said that he will engage in will more directly hit the interests of big U.S. corporations. Increased tax, for example, on petroleum extraction, mining. You know, these are a lot of American companies making a lot of money off of foreign trade with Colombia. And he's pretty directly going to attack the bottom line of these companies, he says. So it remains to be seen how the U.S. responds once those policies start taking effect.
And you'll be available to fill us in as we see, right?
Sure, with pleasure. I think it'll be really interesting to see, actually. The signaling from the Biden administration so far has been positive, maybe even more than I would have expected.
Well, one final question, whether you have any reflections that go more broadly than Colombia itself on what, again, is being called a new pink tide in Latin America.
Yeah, so I think this is a really interesting case of trying to think through what real change looks like and how to accomplish it. Even incarnate in Petro, this is a man who joined a revolutionary movement that sought directly to overthrow the state. And the M19 was the revolutionary movement. They disarmed, actually negotiated a change in the constitution, something that we're seeing now in Chile as part of their contribution to the pink tide. But what we see is that, you know, for decades, there was tremendous, at least if you listen to the CIA and U.S. foreign policy, this sort of tremendous fear of a red tide, of revolutionary change. And now it's, you know, through election, politicians like Petro taking power, Lula in Brazil, who seems like he's going to again be president of Brazil in October elections in Brazil, who have these reformist agendas and then are thinking very seriously about, you know, what can they get done making compromises with powerful elite interests. And I think Petro is a really interesting test case of this. You know, he softened his stance since he was candidate in 2018. He said, I'm not going to expropriate land. Colombia has tremendous, I think, the highest levels of land inequality in Latin America, most of it through violence from the armed conflict, lands that were stolen. And he previously, and I would support this, said, I'm going to expropriate lands to give to campesinos who have nothing. He's softened that stance very specifically. So, yeah, I think there's a specific model for how to create change, thinking realistically. And it'll be interesting to evaluate in 4 years what that's led to in Colombia and also in alliance with other left-wing presidents throughout Latin America. What that means for poor people throughout the region.
We call this part of the old mole, another world is possible. That's what we're going to find out as we monitor what goes on in Latin America and in Colombia. Alex Diamond, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Here's a bit of the music from the Petro Francia presidential campaign.
Colombia, luchamos por la vida. El cambio llegó. El pueblo soñó. Colombia despertó y avanza sin miedo.
¡Que viva Colombia!
Pues el amor es la salida.
Pedro, mi presidente.
And here's old mole Jan Hawken with Mole Sharon Grant, and Sharon's former colleague, Judy McFarland. What was it like creating a new curriculum on sex education for the public schools in Multnomah County? And how did they actually work with the students? Jan?
Welcome to KABU, Sharon Grant and Judy McFarland.
It's good to be here.
Thank you very much. Yes, it is good to be here.
Well, for decades, both the content and the place of sex education in public schools have been sites of intense controversy, particularly driven by the sexual anxieties of the religious right. School boards in conservative areas around the country have faced intense pressure to limit or censor teaching about sexuality, recently targeting LGBTQ-focused curriculum. So Sharon and Judy, it's good to have you here today to talk about your experiences as sexual health educators and your work for decades here in Multnomah County. Let's start with each of you saying a little about your work and what you've done.
Thanks, Jan. I'm Judy McFarland, and I worked for over 25 years in Multnomah County Health Department and the last 16 in adolescent health, primarily focusing on teen pregnancy prevention, healthy relationships, and puberty ed.
So Sharon, what about you?
I also worked at the Multnomah County Health Department. My first job was in 1996, working in what we at the time called the STARS program, which stood for Students Today Aren't Ready for Sex, for sixth graders. And Judy and I worked together on that.
So your work over a period of time followed some of the shifts in sexual health programs and curriculum materials in the schools. Could you say a bit about how these programs that you worked with differed from perhaps classes earlier, the 1960s, when some of the sex ed classes were introduced into the schools with more focus on reproductive organs or basic biology, what some call the plumbing side of sexuality?
Mm-hmm. There was no set curriculum for sex education at the time that we worked there that we wanted to use. So we created our own. And, you know, we had a pretty significant, we had a great group of people who brought all kinds of experience, identification, and knowledge to the program. So we started out with sixth grade, like I said before, and then we later expanded the program to eighth and 10th grades because we had so much really good response from teachers in schools and what we were doing.
So teachers generally have been very supportive of bringing in, so these are specifically classes taught within the context of health teaching,
yes.
Or how have they been, where they have they been located in the school curriculum? Judy, do you want to respond to that as well?
Sure. You know, when I started with the health department, it was in primary care, and there was a movement to assist and collaborate with school districts and community members on beefing up or enhancing sexual health education. And so the program that Sharon is talking about, the STARS program, is a grant-funded program. They did a needs assessment and then did a collaborative agreement with some school districts to get us started. So that's how that came about. And they were looking for best practice curricula, and there wasn't a whole lot out there. I don't know where that particular start originated in terms of the curriculum that we began with. Sharon and I both came on to the STARS program at the same time. But we definitely altered it and enhanced that and built on it so that it could go statewide.
Now, clearly, even with the acronym, Students Today Aren't Ready for Sex, which seems like an aspirational kind of value for some parents, and clearly not the reality of many young people.
Right.
How did you deal with that challenge in addressing parental concerns about sexually active youth versus the reality of what young people are exploring in the world or experiencing in the world around sexuality?
Well, I'd like to take that one on in terms of seeking parent agreement or consent to come into a public school as a health agency. So we took the avenue of public health. We looked at data to say what's going on with our youth. And the name, I don't know how it got put out there, but I believe that the reason STARS got its start in Students Today Aren't Ready for Sex was sort of the adults in the room wanting to come up with something that everybody would go, yeah, that's right, they're not. At sixth grade, as a 12-year-old, you know, it wasn't an overall concept for all school-aged youth, but at that particular time, 12 years old was the population that we were going to be serving, seemed to be common ground.
That's too young to be sexually active.
Given all of
most
the
kids.
Negative consequences or just the barriers that having a pregnant teen might cause. You know, the whole goal was to reduce teen pregnancy, reduce sexually transmitted infections, and give young people a chance to develop before they became sexually active.
Yeah, it was a more abstinence-based education in the sixth grade. Okay. But even for 11 and 12-year-olds, our message was, it's better to wait as opposed to don't do it, which isn't very helpful, especially when we're seeing them in April and May when there's nothing but hormones floating all around the building, you know, even it's within sixth grade. So, and the sixth grade classes were peer-led, right, Jude? So we trained mostly high school juniors and seniors in guiding the curricula and the discussions to include reasons why young people have sex and why they wait, talking about peer pressure, role modeling, refusal skills when kids get in situations that are making them uncomfortable. So it wouldn't be like they had to think about it in the moment.
Right. And exploring media pressures and outside pressures. You know, we looked at magazines, song selections, just talked about the world around them and how it might seem to be sexually active.
So it wasn't just say no to sex.
Oh, no.
Right, right. I mean, and the sixth graders loved having older students come in to work with them. These students had to apply as teachers and get recommendations and be interviewed by us and trained by us. It was like, what was it, 2 days of training we did?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Many used this experience that they had for college and job applications. It was a very popular program.
Absolutely. And many of those students went on to become educators based on that experience.
Yeah.
I remember a couple of kids saying, I have changed what I want to do based on this experience. I want to be able to make a difference and really enhance young people's lives. So that was really positive for them, as well as they got speaking skills. They got some practice in not pushing their values and beliefs, but really guiding discussions that help people come to their own conclusions with a set curricula too.
You know, this reminds me of a lot of the consent curriculum, sexual consent curriculum in colleges and universities that I'm more familiar with, which sometimes are the butt of jokes, but are really important in learning how to talk about sex and to communicate the experiences, the fears and anxieties and desires that are attached to sexuality. And it seems like a lot of what you're doing is teaching young people to have a larger vocabulary and a way of communicating about an area of life that is sometimes assumed to be just spontaneous urges or surges of of hormones, but it's more than just surges of hormones. There's a lot about how you communicate desire.
It was fun to watch the high school students help the younger kids figure out what they wanted to say.
So what was the experience of high school kids? You were saying with younger kids, they really did seem to welcome this space to talk about sexuality and to draw on older students' experiences. What was it like for the older students?
Well, in the 8th and 10th grades, we included a lot of music and media influences. We showed drawings that explained all of sexual anatomy and all the parts, included talking about the clitoris. We did not ignore that, which was often ignored in sexuality education.
Yes, that's a difference from the 1960 sex ed. Which,
yeah, you know, it was a difference.
Female body was basically a tube.
Yes. You know, we performed condom demonstrations on our fingers in there, discussed, you know, why it was necessary to use them every time. I mean, you could practically hear a pin drop in those classrooms most of the time. There might have been a little giggling, but, you know, I considered that totally age appropriate. It was a building block. So they got it in 6th grade, they got it in 8th grade, and they got it in 10th grade.
So I wanted to also take up LGBTQ issues as an era of sexuality that where conservatives have really targeted teachers and curriculum materials around even, you know, that whole don't say gay idea. How did you address queer students or issues of queer sexuality?
And we had a number of LGBTQ students, well, I should say I did, and I'm pretty sure other staff members did as well, who came out to us in the classroom, you know, where there are other students in the class who may have known and may not have known, but somehow they felt comfortable in our presence and in the presence of older students, and given where this curriculum was going, felt comfortable saying that they were gay or lesbian or queer or however they wanted to express themselves. I had that experience in Portland Public several times.
How do you think sexual health programs have been affected by the pandemic and some of the struggles kids are having now? Could either of you address that?
Sure. You know, one of the things that I think about with the pandemic is Zoom classes and students being able to be off camera. They're missing out a lot of the social interactions, being able to read a room, so to speak, reading expressions, talking about consent and how do you get that? And it's, you know, online is very different. People tend to say and do a lot of things that they wouldn't do in person, but they're not getting any practice with that personal interaction face to face with this pandemic. So we've kind of stalled their development in terms of catching them up now that they're back in the classroom.
Okay, I was reading this article earlier, this teacher who gives sex education presentations in middle and high schools in Minnesota says her reach as a teacher has expanded during stay-at-home orders. She usually makes her rounds at cities, you know, but in the last 9 months, she's been able to do everything online and go to, instead of driving all over the place, has the ability to reach a lot more kids.
Yeah, sex online is not necessarily a bad thing.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, well, I hope to have you both on the Old Mole again, and we'll continue this conversation. You just bring so much experience and wisdom to an area that's, for many people, fraught with anxiety.
Yes, I would love that.
Okay. I would love that as well. Thanks for having us.
Okay. Thanks so much, Sharon Grant and Judy McFarland.
Jen Hocken, Sharon Grant, and Judy McFarland will record a follow-up conversation on how issues of gender and sexual identity entered their teaching, and specifically how they worked with LGBTQ students. Stay tuned for that in a future Old Mole broadcast. Now we turn to the recent Inflation Reduction Act, being touted as a great victory for President Biden and for the climate justice movement. How transformative will it be? As Old Mole Bill Resnick and his guest Howie Hawkins examine the act, their question is, transformative to what? To a status quo vision of continuing corporate domination, or to the democratic and sustainable better world we know is possible? Importantly, they ask how we can build on the potential unleashed by the act. Bill?
Hi, Howie Hawkins. Welcome to KBOO.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Howie Hawkins was a Green Party candidate for president in 2020. He got smothered because most of the voters who preferred Howie on the Green Party platform, and a lot of them, they felt compelled to vote for the lesser evil, that is Biden. But from another perspective today, Howie and the Greens did really well because over the years, the Greens and many other climate action groups and some in Congress, like Bernie Sanders, they succeeded in building public support for climate action and pushing the Democrats and Biden to make climate action, they say, their number one priority. And recently, the Democrats surprised us by enacting the mislabeled Inflation Reduction Act. It should be called the Climate Action Act. It's been characterized by reputable folks as transformative, which I don't think is exaggeration. But transformative to what? Will it be corporate America's vision of a clean energy future, with them continuing to dominate the economy and politics and ransack the planet for profits? That's no different from today, except for being powered by sun and wind energy. Or will it be a transformation to the left's vision of that better, necessary, democratic, sustainable, possible world? At the heart of that world is the cities building out sun and wind power, forming a public agency or authority, run democratically, leading the crusade for sun and wind installations, and also energy conservation and use reduction. So, Howie, tell us about the Climate Action Act.
Well, like any piece of legislation, how it's implemented makes all the difference in the world. Now, the overall picture, I call it Build Back Badly compared to Build Back Better, which itself was insufficient to really deal with the climate crisis. You know, the spending on renewable energy is 5% of what was originally proposed by Biden. But within the legislation, there's some important things that we have to work on. One of them is it gives the Environmental Protection Agency, against decisions by the Supreme Court, the power to regulate carbon dioxide as a pollutant, which means we have regulatory powers we didn't have before this act. And then what it does in terms of the incentives, which I think are problematic in general because it's all about incentives to private corporations so the corporations remain in charge. But what changed is that public power utilities can also get these incentives where before they couldn't. And that's where we can really work on implementing renewable generation energy efficiency programs in our communities where we have public power. And, you know, that's big cities like Cleveland and Los Angeles and Sacramento, as well as really there are over 2,000 public power utilities in the country. Many of them are small municipals, but there's a lot of work we can do there. And where we don't have them, you know, maybe we fight to get public power so we can take advantage of the incentives, the subsidies that are provided to produce renewable energy in this bill.
It seems to me it's a huge pile of money to do exactly what we need to be done, which is build out quickly. The corporate sector does not want to do it quickly. They want to take their time so that they don't strand their assets. Cities are not going to strand any assets. They can build out energy and apparently can get federal dollars to do it. And there's been no cap on the amounts that can be requested. That's almost too good to believe, yeah. But I think that's how it's starting now, at least, for cities and states.
Well, there's $30 billion in the bill to build renewable generation, solar panels, wind turbines, battery storage. It also includes processing the critical minerals that are needed for these materials, and utilities, public power utilities, are involved in that latter industry. But there's $30 billion there, and, you know, you're right. The public power utilities have to get in the line quickly before the big solar and wind companies who are geared up to do this apply for that money, and it runs out. It's $30 billion over 10 years. That's $3 billion a year. So
that's not much,
compared to
actually
what's needed. Huh?
That's not much. $3 billion a year sounds like a lot, but it doesn't buy very much anymore.
Right. So, you know, what we can hope is that one of these big public power utilities gets the money and sets up an exemplary system, and then others see how well it works, and it creates momentum to do the same thing elsewhere.
Yeah, that's a very strong point. If we can model in, let's say, Los Angeles and Cleveland, or any of the other big cities, Burbank, there are lots of cities of more than 200,000 that have public power. If we can model very rapid transition to renewable energy, that's going to make it very difficult for the corporate sector to gain the authority to direct the mobilization when the country becomes alive to the realization that they're in deep, deep trouble. And that realization is growing, it seems to me, very rapidly. Howie, let's talk about a couple of the other things, just touch on them, that are in the bill. They also have a fee for releasing methane from fracking or any kind of extraction method for fossil fuels. And the fee gets greater as the amounts get greater. It seems to me that methane now has become a very dangerous. There's so much of it now being released. That seems to me, if it's enforced, really important. And in other parts of the law, they encourage states, it encourages states to adopt California law right now to phase out gas-powered cars by 2035. And, of course, they have big cash payments for buying electric cars. It seems to me those are steps in the right direction.
Well, the methane fee you can get by carbon capture and sequestration, and that's problematic because right now 12 out of 13 carbon capture facilities are using the carbon capture to pump into oil wells, get more oil out of the fracked oil wells that they've drilled. So it could be a subsidy for more fossil fuel production, you know, oil production. So that's the problem there. I mean, in general, if they gave the, well, you pay for releasing it. So the incentive is to capture it. But then the question is where it goes. And as one analyst of this bill pointed out, you'll need 65,000 miles of CO2 pipelines to reach the level of carbon capture assumed in the models about this bill. Because you've heard that these models say this is going to reduce carbon emissions by 40%, but they have really high assumptions about the amount of carbon that will be captured when the fossil fuels were still burning. And it would take 65,000 miles of pipeline to be able to pipe that carbon to where it would be injected into the ground. And unfortunately, most of it would be oil wells. So that's
very problematic.
Methane piece is very problematic.
Very problematic. I don't think they're going to get very far on it. It's a boondoggle to the coal companies. What's your sense of what we did right over the last 20 years to build a constituency for the energy, for a possible energy transformation? And how can the left encourage and sometimes force and cities and states and public utilities now to seize the opportunity for building out the clean, renewable sun and wind energy?
Well, I would say we've been at this for 50 years, really, since Earth Day. I know I was involved in the Anti-Nuclear Clamshell Alliance, and we were talking about the jobs are in renewables. They're cheaper than nuclear and safer than fossil fuels as well. And we've won that argument with the public. There's no doubt about that, despite enormous corporate-funded propaganda saying there is no climate problem and that kind of thing. So even though their scientists were telling them there is. So we've won that argument. Now it's not so much a debate as to whether there's climate change. It's a debate about what to do about it. And we got to keep pushing because while this bill has some gestures in the right direction, the scale is totally inadequate to what we need. And we need to do a lot more through the public sector instead of trying to incentivize corporations that got us into this mess in the first place. There's coming up a bill. It was a side deal because they couldn't put it in this Inflation Reduction Act because it was non-budgetary, but it's easing the permitting pipelines for natural gas and oil and CO2, and that can be defeated. I don't know what the balance forces is in Congress. I know a lot of progressives are saying they're against it. I think the big question will be whether the Republicans say we're against it too because the Democrats proposed it, because otherwise they'd be with the oil industry and the gas industry. So that's a big fight. If we can stop that, then we can fight pipeline by pipeline, project by project against these corporate plans to continue the fossil fuel age. So, you know, there are big battles ahead, and $30 billion is certainly not enough to build out, you know, solar and wind. There's $80 billion in consumer incentives for electric vehicles and heat pumps and solar panels, but they're really biased toward the affluent. I mean, electric vehicles, you know, average price for a new one is $65,000, and you can get a $7,500 tax credit. It is refundable, so even if you're low income, you can, and you're not deducting things like that from your taxes, you can get it back. But when it comes to heat pumps, and energy efficiency applications at home, those are not refundable, which means you have to have the tax liability to deduct it from. So there's a lot of improvement there in terms of the consumer subsidies. So I think, you know, we got to take what this is, use the parts we can, but then push for much, much more because, you know, we're running out of time. You mentioned methane before. You know, the studies now say that one third of the global warming is attributable to methane, which over a 20-year period, it dissolves faster in the atmosphere, is over 80 times more potent in heating the planet. And, you know, so we got a serious problem there. We're running out of time. So I think, yeah, we won the argument. Now we got to translate public opinion into public policy that's a lot stronger than what we have so far.
Amen, Howie. There's a chorus of amens from the congregation. Hey, thanks for talking to us today. Keep up the good work. You may not win the presidency, but maybe the people can win the war against our corporate friends. Thanks a lot.
Well, thanks for having me.
And there you have it. Action around climate change, sex education in our public schools, a possible turning point in Latin America. I'd like to thank today's participants, Old Mole's Jan Hawken, Sharon Grant, Bill Resnick, Patricia Kohlberg, and John Nelson, and our guests, Alex Diamond, Judy McFarland, and Howie Hawkins. Thanks also to the dedicated KBOO staff, who continue to keep the station going under sometimes difficult circumstances. We'll leave you with a bit more of Colombian campaign music. This has been Norm Diamond. Till next Monday morning, stay safe and stay active.
Cambiaremos explotación por arte y una canción, violencia por educación y ciencia. Con el conocimiento y el saber podremos retomar el pensar, andar bonito, porque somos libres de escoger nuestro destino. Esta vez ganaremos en las urnas con millones de compatriotas y sentaremos las bases de la transición hacia una Colombia humana, potencia de la vida y de la paz.
Petro, mi presidente.